Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this Courthouse Steps preview on the case Trump v. CASA, Incorporated. Speaking with us today, we're very pleased to have the Solicitor General of West Virginia, Michael Williams, and the former Solicitor General of West Virginia, Albert Lynn, who will be moderating today. Albert is now the Chair of Issues and Appeals at Hunton Andrews Kurth. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speaker, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Near the end of the program, we may turn to the audience for questions. So if you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. And finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Michael and Albert, thanks so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thanks, Edie. And thank you to the Federal Society for hosting. So I'm here with my friend and successor of sorts, Michael Williams. As Edie said, Michael is the Solicitor General of West Virginia and filed a brief on behalf of the state in this matter. Before joining the West Virginia AG's office, Michael practiced in the private sector and was also a law clerk to Judge AG of the Fourth Circuit. And then also to Chief Judge Chazanow.
Exactly. Yep.
On the District of Maryland. And I should also note that Michael has survived one AG and is now into his second AG. Thanks for doing this with me, Michael, and also for letting me ask the questions and you being the one who answers the questions. But let's start with just a little background to make sure everyone is on the same page. This is a sort of an interesting posture here. On the merits, these cases, I guess there are really three of them, are about the president's birthright citizenship executive order. But that's not the issue we're going to hear argued tomorrow. Again, maybe, or maybe not. Can you elaborate and set the table for us?
Yeah, so this is an issue that I think has been bouncing around the Supreme Court for some time now. And the real issue at the centerpiece of all this is the legality or appropriateness of what some people call nationwide injunctions, but I'm going to call universal injunctions today. The court, we've had a few justices writing separately on these issues for a while now, kind of raising the question of whether these broad nationwide injunctions actually are appropriate for district courts to issue, but it's never actually squarely decided the issue. So it looks like they're maybe getting excited and getting ready to finally answer the question of whether district courts can take action here in the way that we see in these three cases. So these are actually three separate cases that were filed in three district courts by a mixture of democratically led states, certain individuals who are either non-citizens of the United States, or I guess potentially non-citizens of the United States, depending on how you construe this order, or advocacy organizations or other affected persons. But they filed a challenge to President Trump's day one birthright citizenship executive order, which basically, as I think most of you guys know, prescribed that certain persons who were here in the United States, but not necessarily under lawful permanent resident status, or maybe just a temporary stay, for instance, and their parents are not citizens of the United States, that those persons are not themselves citizens of the United States. So these advocacy organizations, these individuals, these states went to three district courts and got three different nationwide or universal injunctions. And those injunctions effectively prescribe that the executive order cannot be enforced as to any person in the United States anywhere. So that's not just as to the members of the organizations, it's not just as to the individuals, it's not just to even citizens of the particular states in front of them, but really anybody in the United States at all. And I suppose, in a sense, you could even say anybody outside the United States who might be coming to the United States with sort of a questionable citizenship status under this order. So the government basically took this issue up to various circuit courts and said, hey, please dial back these overly broad injunctions. the circuit courts declined to tailor those injunctions to the specific parties before them. So now the government is before the Supreme Court on applications for injunction pending appeal. So this is sort of the shadow docket or the emergency docket or whatever you'd like to call this. It's not sort of a traditional petition for cert merits case. It is a sort of one of these sort of preliminary interstitial kind of applications. So it is being argued as a full case, but it is a slightly different posture in that it is on the emergency docket on expedited briefing, kind of coming up through this injunction process. So I think I've got.
You know, you have. Yeah, but just to kind of like put a finer point on that, right? This is not a case where the court has deemed the application a petition for cert. There is no QP, I guess, technically. Do you think that's meaningful in any way? I mean, will it affect what they talk about tomorrow?
I think it will. I think if they had treated it as a petition for cert, as they've done in a few of the sort of maybe more controversial cases in recent years, that might have signaled that they were ready to get more into the merits of the case. But I think keeping it in this sort of posture is sort of another signal that the court is specifically focused on the remedial issue and not the sort of substantive merits question of whether President Trump got it right in construing what birthright citizenship really means.
Okay. Yeah, that's helpful. There are some, I noticed some amici who only address the underlying merits, notwithstanding the focus of the government's application.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting. We see this a lot, I think, where a particular case is really only focused on a procedural issue or a remedial issue, and people kind of want to run ahead and dive all the way in. But that actually, I mean, that kind of goes to one of the points that, for instance, we as West Virginia wanted to make, which is that you're jumping into the merits question too early, that this is an underdeveloped record and it's all kind of on an expedited basis. And so people are really wrestling with these issues at a frantic pace with very little facts. And it seems to me like the court is saying, no, let's put that aside for the moment. Let's really focus on this remedial issue.
So your last point there kind of bleeds into my next question, which is, you know, so we are here to talk about universal injunctions. What's all the fuss about, right? I mean, it feels like we've seen tons of these over the past few presidential administrations. We saw something very similar at West Virginia's request under my tenure. For the first version of the Clean Power Plan, although we can get into whether that's different later. I'm sort of curious about, I mean, why does your state care? I mean, it does seem to be sort of, it's a good for the goose, good for the gander thing as the parties switch sides. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I'll take the easy one, and maybe you could probably answer this one just as well as I can. Why does West Virginia care? I think West Virginia has, as far back as your tenure, always sort of had a special interest in structural limitations of federal power. I think Professor Bradford Clark, I think, has written about how separation of powers and the structural limitations of our Constitution often serve the interests of the states as well, because to the extent that various branches are overreaching, they're often doing so at the expense of traditional state power. So we kind of take that very seriously. And I think so in any number of cases, we've kind of aggressively sought to police those limits. West Virginia v. EPA, of course, was the limits of a federal agency's power, at least in the absence of express congressional direction. But this case is kind of similar, right? It's the particular bounds of a federal court's power, at least in the absence of express congressional direction. And it presents some of the same concerns for us, that really it's going to invite district courts to overextend themselves in ways that can ultimately be destructive to our interests and ultimately to everyone's interests, to the extent that our balance of powers is upset. I think you're right that there is a little bit of a goose gander problem. Maybe I won't call it a problem, just a reality. This is not actually a strict partisan issue, in that there's kind of an interesting mix of more conservatively minded states that think that universal injunctions are great and an important tool against administrative overreach in particular. There's another set of states that maybe more consistently with West Virginia's present philosophy think that It's just not consistent with the structure of our court system to invite these sorts of remedies. I think the same is true on the other side. You saw sort of democratically minded states sometimes are asking for universal remedies, but some of them were sort of very aggressively lashing out against the concept when it was being used by those more aggressive conservative AGs, for instance. So there is it's kind of an interesting mix here. But I think that ultimately gets to your first question, which is why this really matters. I mean, it really goes to the fundamental conception of what our federal courts are supposed to do. I think there are some who think that federal courts are just supposed to, when confronted with a problem, do whatever is necessary to resolve the problem, however broadly conceived. And I think that there are some who take a more narrow, circumscribed view of what federal courts can and should be doing. And I think that's maybe more of the approach that we view, that it really is about addressing, taking the narrowest appropriate avenue to addressing the particular problem in front of the court. And to the extent that they're going farther, that's really a real issue.
Your comment about it not really being partisan, I was reminded yesterday that Elizabeth Prelogar, SG under Biden, had asked the court to take up the universal injunction issue as well, I think right before the administration turned over. I can't remember the case that it was, but
right. It wasn't the Idaho case, was it? I know that was a statewide injunction, but it had similar issues.
Yeah, I can't remember what it was, but I do think it so it is. I mean, there is strange bedfellows maybe on this one.
Yeah, there are.
So you mentioned, I want to get into the arguments for and against, because I think people are probably interested in that as we preview the argument, but I do want have one more sort of table setting question for you. You mentioned that the court has had lots of opportunities to address this issue. I just mentioned one where Solicitor General Prelogar asked for it. I think Law 360 did an article yesterday where they had a list of the cases in which this has come up, including all the way back to the DAPA case, Texas versus United States out of the Fifth Circuit, where they, and for whatever reason, I think sometimes the issue sort of mooted itself or they haven't had to address it. But I mean, why do you have any thoughts as to why now? I mean, this is a kind of a really interesting vehicle for it to come up in. And maybe you'll get into this in terms of the arguments in support of universal injunctions. I mean, does sort of feel like if there were a case for universal injunctions as a practical matter, this might be one. But any speculation as to what's caused them to kind of take it up now?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think that we have seen in some of these separation of power structural question cases, the court has liked to have a sort of developing set of concurring and dissenting opinions come ahead of their ultimate resolution. I think we saw some of that in the major questions context. We've certainly seen that in the context of the non-delegation doctrine, for instance. It's almost like, I call it miniature percolation, right? It's the justices letting the issue percolate among themselves. And then we were kind of realized that we're reaching a flash point where, okay, fine, you guys have wrung your hands enough. It's time to actually get to the point. And I can't tell you why they picked this particular one. I think you're right that if I were sort of a strategically minded justice who really wanted to strike down the notion of universal injunctions, I probably would not have picked this case. But it may just be that they saw maybe one of the few applications that teed it up just as the single issue that was in front of it. My memory might be faulty here, but I'm not sure I remember one where the only issue in front of them was really the appropriateness of the remedy itself. And so they might have just seen that as an opportunity to kind of write on a clean slate and not have to get bound up in parsing out, I guess I'll call them QPs for this purpose, but parsing out the issues and trying to kind of wave away at merits issues. And they kind of took the bait that the government gave them on this one. But it's frankly always dangerous to guess what they're doing, but that's my best guess here.
Yeah, Justice Thomas used to ask us what we thought the results would be after oral argument. He thought it was funny because even those working at the court didn't really know how the court was going to come out. So, let's pivot to the arguments. And someone has asked us to address the history as to how the universal injunction remedy began. I assume you might get into that. Since it's the government is challenging them, let's start with the legal arguments against universal injunctions. What are we going to hear tomorrow? You guys went through some of them in your brief.
Well, Rod provided me the perfect segue, apparently, because the history actually is critical here. One of the most important arguments against these universal injunctions is effectively that federal courts have to look to their historic powers and really the historic powers of the English Court of Chancery in defining the reach of their own equitable jurisdiction. And so there is a lot of debate in the briefs that actually focused on the issue about what that history says. I think there is, for the most part, there is agreement that there was no real universal injunction in the early days of American courts. I think that there's some debate about whether you saw something at least like universal injunctions come up around the 1930s or perhaps even a little earlier. I think I'm going to mispronounce her name, but Professor Sahani, I think, has written on these issues. The 30s are kind of a moment when we did see some initial gesturing towards the notion of what we now would conceive of as a universal injunction. And then there was a little bit of a quiet period, I think, for the next 1 to 2, maybe 3 decades. And then particularly in the sort of the civil rights era of the 60s and on into the 70s, then we started seeing courts getting re-engaging with this idea of universal injunctions. But even then, it was really a sporadic thing. It was really only as recently as I would say the Obama era that we really started seeing more frequent requests for universal injunctions and courts actually granting them. And then the numbers have really exploded since then. I think the statistics really show that particularly in the second half or so of the Obama administration, then on into the first Trump administration, the numbers just started skyrocketing. And I think it's just maybe just a snowballing effect that courts began to get a little more comfortable with the idea, and then it just gained some steam. And then maybe there are a couple circuits like the Ninth Circuit who actually expressly said, we're okay with this idea, so go for it. But really, it's at least particularly in our view, it's a relatively modern creation. And even if it wasn't of modern creation, its use has just infinitely exploded in I'd say the last couple decades or so. So that history informs the courts, their understanding of their own equitable jurisdiction, because they say we have to look to history to find our own scope. And I think one of the questions that the court really is going to be asking is, you know, what are those, are there real historical roots here, or is this just a reaction to the increasingly polarized nature of our politics, right? But in terms of other arguments against universal injunctions, I think the government actually has an appealingly simple argument, which is just that Article 3 only addresses cases and controversies, and it only addresses the particular parties before the court, and that even mechanisms like class actions sort of retain respect for those fundamental notions, and universal injunctions just don't. And so ultimately, that's the root problem, is that inconsistency with Article 3's conception of what district courts can do. And then from there, you have all kinds of problems that result. You have gamesmanship in terms of people going to preferred venues and just filing serial litigation until they get a win. And then, you know, good for them. they've got their remedy, and the government doesn't ever get the benefit of the win. They just have to keep fighting them over and over and over. Or you have the problem that I kind of alluded to earlier, where you're not getting well-developed records, you're not getting the appropriate percolation, you're not getting all those kinds of good benefits of having multiple tracks of individualized litigation. I mean, those are some of a couple of sort of the pragmatic problems that I think the government identifies, but it ultimately stems from the same fundamental problem, which is just this inconsistency with how Article 3 conceives the judicial power as limited to cases and controversies. They do, you know, they do get into notions of standing as well, and that's obviously related to cases and controversies and the parties before. And they do take particular interest in attacking the states in this context, because I think the government, and maybe this is why they decided to take the shot here, the government does have a reasonable argument, I think, that the birthright citizenship issue is sort of uniquely individualized, and that to the extent that states are purporting to seek remedies for themselves, it's sort of parents patriae in the extreme. It just doesn't work anymore. Those are a couple of the big points. I'm sure I've just oversimplified all of John's great work on that issue, but those are at least some of the problems that the government's flagged in its application.
Can I ask you one follow-up question that related to the brief you guys filed and something that you said? Do you view the historical argument and the separation of powers argument as sort of independent legal problems, or are they interrelated?
I think they're related, but I will say that the court has sort of seemed to treat them as independent, and I can't confess to really reconcile that. And I think the historical analysis informs those sort of structural problems. I think that, you know, the framers wrote our Constitution with an eye towards that history. And there's plenty of cases that say that, of course, our understandings of our own constitutions are informed by that history as well. So I think they're interrelated, but I just don't see the cases sort of tying them together in a good, clean way. And maybe that's what the court actually can help us do one way or the other in this decision.
Yeah. So you could end up with an opinion like the major questions one, where people are wondering whether it's constitutionally rooted or just like a judicially created presumption.
Judicial pragmatism, right.
Right. So what about the other side of it? What are the arguments in support of a universal injunction? And I don't know if you want to get into this, but I take it that some of the arguments, at least in this case, are not even necessarily in defense of universal injunctions, but just that the court doesn't need to reach the question here. So maybe there's both.
There absolutely are both. I think maybe the most convincing argument that the court doesn't need to reach the universal injunction issue is that this isn't a universal injunction so much as a broad injunction meant to fully address the harms felt by the individual persons in front of them. And so the Georgetown Clinic brief, for instance, says the nature of citizenship is such that you can't say one person can present a birth certificate as evidence of citizenship in the United States while their next door neighbor can't, that just doesn't work. And so there is a certain, when we talk about judicial pragmatism, there is a certain appeal to that argument. I take the point. So I think they've talked a bit about that. They've also talked a bit about, some of them are focused more on, is this really kind of a cert-worthy issue ultimately? And whether the court even needs to really, whether they engage with it on the facts of this case. And I think I'm less convinced by that. I think that some of the justices have kind of alluded to that standard a time or two, but I think that's not going to, it's not just going to be what's going to decide this case. But then beyond sort of those, I guess, threshold questions is this even really a universal injunction case? They make a strong defense, I think, for why they might be useful. I'm maybe less convinced by some of the policy arguments are all well and good, I suppose, but they make a less convincing case to me when it comes to the constitutional limits, because I think that we see some people trying to twist a little bit of the history and stretch a little bit on sort of looking for historical analogs, maybe in the same way we've seen some stretching in the Bruin context with historical analogs. And we've seen a little bit of stretching in terms of what it means to address only the party in front of you. I find those arguments less convincing, and I ultimately am inclined to think that that's really what's going to decide this case. But that also might just be because I've buried myself in the opposition position for the past couple of weeks.
So let me ask this follow-up. I think one of the things that I've heard a lot about in terms of the defense is that this is a case where, in order to grant complete relief, which I think is sort of your initial point,
right,
has to be an injunction of sufficient breadth.
Right.
Do you think the court can separate that from the universal injunction question, or does it sort of collapse, right? Like, is it a situation where you need universal injunctions in some cases to provide complete relief, but where there isn't, for example, then, you know, there's all these other limitations? Or does it, kind of the way you suggested, does it just mean that this isn't a universal injunction? It's just right? Like, is there a difference between saying it's a universal injunction that provides complete relief, that is necessary for complete relief, or is it simply not a universal injunction at all?
That's a really interesting question. I'm not sure that anyone actually has sussed that out yet. I think that my honest answer is that I think it's probably better conceived as affording complete relief for the party before you is not the same as a universal injunction, because I think, at least particularly in the academic literature, it's focused more on the idea that the federal court thinks it can take on a problem writ large, and that sort of is a much more problematic aggrandizement of judicial power, right? That just indulges a notion of judicial power that just is seriously problematic. I think it would be much easier for the court to say that is not okay. And then, so then I guess it'll be interesting to see if they have to kind of make a factual determination of what complete relief really is required here, and whether there's ever a circumstance in which just a blanket injunction, quasi-declaration across the board is required to address a particular factual scenario. I can't conceive of one, to be honest with you, where to provide complete relief, you would have to have an injunction across the board. But I'm also not necessarily as creative as some of these people are. So
let me ask you another follow up. Are we looking at sort of Chief Justice Roberts trying to, Marbury versus Madison, this one? I mean, does he say complete relief requires a super broad injunction here, but universal injunctions. And so that's not a universal injunction, but universal injunctions are bad and don't have a historical analog, right? So, he finds a vehicle to rule on it without denying the relief here.
I can see that. Yeah. And that's sort of, you just put it better than I did. That's sort of what I'm trying to get. But the only issue I'd have there is I'm not sure he's got the votes. I mean, then I'm thinking he's got maybe like a Roberts opinion that's the narrowest opinion. And then you've got the ones who we know are not going to sign on to this at all. And I mean, know as much as one can know. and then it's just a question of whether he gets sort of the left side of the court to go with him on a philosophy like that. Mm-hmm. I see that as plausible for his position. I just, I'm having some trouble making the math work in terms of getting an opinion for the court.
Yeah. Let's talk about consequences going forward. I mean, I think I tend to agree with you that the fact that they set this for argument suggests that there's going to be something of consequence that comes out of this argument. So Professor Frost has argued that these injunctions are a method of cabining executive power. Right. Let's assume that some limitation is put on universal injunctions. How does it affect the balance of power? How does that affect litigation against the government going forward? Right. I mean, I think it'll look presumably somewhat different, or maybe not. Maybe there are alternatives to universal injunctions.
Yeah, I think there are alternatives. We flagged one of them in our brief. At the same time, I think that the litigation is going to necessarily look different. So if I'm a public interest organization, I all of a sudden am looking to hire class action experts because, and they do a lot of that already. We're defending some of them as the state. But I think that the easiest path to getting relief that's close at least to a universal injunction is to certify a class, right? And so all of a sudden you're litigating maybe expedited Rule 23 motions right out of the gate, which actually does seem consistent with the rule. And then now, of course, everybody's bound by the judgment as well. So some of the problems that arise from a universal injunction are at least mitigated, right? Because you don't get that serial litigation prospect, for instance, that you might with a universal injunction. But I do think they're going to have to rethink this a little bit in that, just finding one sympathetic organization is not going to be necessarily good enough to get you the broad relief that you otherwise would have been entitled to under a universal injunction regime. I suppose another alternative is that they say universal injunctions are okay, but that they sort of use some of the language they've already written where they're disfavored, and they sort of raise the standard of proof. And then I guess the litigation looks very similar to the way it does now. It's just going to be harder for plaintiffs to actually win under a heightened burden of proof. And maybe that means that the process doesn't move as quickly because they actually have to develop a record, like a more comprehensive record. But those are just a couple of ways I suppose it would be different. But I don't think it's not going to be the case that there's just no route to getting relief for big groups of people on big issues like this. I mean, we've seen attempts to certify classes of habeas petitioners. So those are potentially creative solutions to a world where there is no universal injunction.
The the sort of strongly worded admonition route sounds like what happened with Chevron for like 10 years.
Right.
Then they were like, no one's really, somebody asked, you know, or if the court says these are improper, too broad, will it actually stop judges? I mean, I think my own view is if the court says that they're not permitted or they put limitations on them, you know, I think the lower courts generally at least pay lip service to that. If it's merely just a strongly worded letter from the U.S. Supreme Court,
right?
Who knows, right, how that plays out.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Chevron, I think of our, the Kaiser opinion that says, shame on you. We meant this to be really rigorous this whole time and everyone just misunderstood us. And, I could see them writing something like that. In fact, I could see Justice Kagan writing something like that and getting some votes for that. But I do think to our questioner, I think if it is written like that, then I think you will always have creatively minded judges who, particularly given maybe some of the calls of we're facing constitutional crises in some of these cases, feel the need to respond still with universal injunctions. I don't think that would be enough to stop them.
So let me raise one other alternative that, two other alternatives. I'll save my pet issue for a second. But what about, I filed a brief on behalf of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which I probably should have flagged earlier. In support of neither party, but addressing a very small issue that we'll talk about in a minute. But one thing that we noted in our brief and that you noted in your brief is that seeking an injunction or some kind of remedy under the Administrative Procedure Act, where you're challenging, say, a rule from a federal agency as opposed to an executive order, it is different. Can you kind of elaborate on... I don't know, maybe what you guys meant by that, so it's not hearsay or speculation. I mean, you know what you thought.
I think what we maybe said was it could be, or different considerations would be involved. So I don't know fair enough. We've actually got a firm state of West Virginia position, and I'm not in a purport to offer that. But I think what the consideration at play is there is a difference between almost acting as a court of review in the APA context. I mean, it's a petition for review, and courts are very comfortable just vacating decisions of lower courts. And so I think almost by analogy to that power, circuit courts or district courts or whoever could act as sort of a court of review to vacate a rule without exercising its equitable power in the same way as we're talking about in a case like this one. And it may be that a preliminary injunction might be sort of an ancillary power to kind of serve that recognized ability to vacate the whole of a rule. And there's a lot of good writing about this, and I'm sure I just botched it. But I think there is a recognition that those are at least distinct powers because they come from sort of two different philosophies of what the court's doing. One is really like the judiciary thrusting itself in and constraining the executive. And the other is, you know, exercising a congressionally delegated power to say, no, this rule can't stand, try again, which some people just see those as the same. I see them as slightly different. But I do think that even if the court takes the most aggressive approach and says universal injunctions are barred, don't do anything like them, that won't answer the question of whether how APA review looks and what remedies are still on the table in the context of APA review.
Right, which is a significant chunk of the litigation against the government. If I'm remembering correctly, I think Justice Kavanaugh flagged in the mini percolation that you talked about, one of his opinions did say that he thought the APA context might be different because it says that the courts shall have the power to set aside a rule, right? Where was I going with this? The APA and Justice Kavanaugh. Well, it's now slipped my mind what I was going to say, but I do think that is, maybe that answers potentially the question I asked you before about why now. I haven't gone back to look at the other opportunities they had, but if they arose under the APA, perhaps this is the best vehicle that they've had to dodge that issue and address universal injunctions.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case. And I think the only times that we, for instance, I think you and I were chatting before we got on officially, I guess, but the only times that we as a state, I think, have really pursued anything that would approach universal relief has been in the APA context, precisely because there is that distinction. So I think it's just a different animal, and I think the court's going to have to address that separately.
Let me ask you and see, I mean, if you've got any thoughts on the sort of issue that the chamber brief addressed. So, the government said in their application, not only did they take on universal injunctions, but they also took on the concept of an association or an organization suing and obtaining an injunction on behalf of all of its members. For those who aren't familiar with how associational litigation works, you often have to identify a couple members for purposes of standing or something. And the government has said, but you don't identify all of them. In fact, one of the benefits of suing as an association is that, you know, not everybody has to come forward. And the government said, I think fair to say in passing in its application, because it's mainly focused on universal injunctions and state standing, the court should also limit the injunction for the association here to the members that were actually identified in litigation. I don't know if you've got a thought on that or whether the court is going to reach that issue, but that was sort of an interesting aside that the government raised in this case.
It is interesting, and obviously, as you know, being the expert on this, it's an issue that has popped up a time or two, mostly in Justice Thomas's writings, raising this question of whether we should abandon associational standing altogether. I think the simple answer is that I find it extremely unlikely that the court will reach this issue in this particular case. They sort of have enough on their plate. Everything I say today is not for the state of West Virginia, but I'm going to put sort of an extra special disclaimer on what I'm about to say. That's only my personal view. I find it unlikely that the court will actually side with the government at any point on that issue. I think it's a favorite of Justice Thomas and maybe one or two others. But I just think when you talk about your earlier question, will litigation change based on what the court says here? I mean, holding that there's no associational standing would upset all kinds of established law. I mean, it's very hard to really understand all the collateral consequences of that kind of holding. So if they're really going to go, I find it unlikely that they're ever going to get there. And if they do, I would expect there to be some more of that mini percolation, I guess, maybe more than just a couple of Thomas opinions flagging the issue. I think that's, you're going to need to see some incrementalist movement towards that outcome before we get there.
Yeah. Somebody said to me once about this whole concept of obtaining broad relief, right? That it's like you've got a balloon and you squeeze part of the balloon, you squeeze the universal injunction part of the balloon and the air goes somewhere else. I think you're right that the balloon changes in its shape, but there will still be means and methods of seeking broad relief.
Yeah. I mean, one of the good examples I give you is, and I guess I'll just say an ATF rule because now I can't remember which ATF rule, but I think maybe it was pistol brace. There was a favorable decision for plaintiffs, including associational plaintiffs, in a challenge to an ATF rule. Let's put aside the APA distinctions just for purposes of this discussion. And so an injunction was entered in favor of those institutional plaintiffs or organizational plaintiffs. Basically, all the gun owners in America raced to sign up for this gun group because they wanted to have the benefit of the injunction. That is a workaround. That's another way of the balloon moving, I guess. I will say, again, not speaking for the state, but it's challenging sometimes for us as the state when we get these injunctions entering against us, because even just the process of implementing or enforcing or making sure that we're complying with the terms of an injunction becomes extraordinarily challenging because membership roles can change. And so is it our obligation to kind of check the website, make sure that we know who's on the voter rolls that week? Or is it only a membership as of the time that the order is entered? Or is it a later time? Is it a fluid class? I'm sympathetic to the concerns that Justice Thomas has expressed, and I get why he's raising these questions. But as I said, I remain skeptical that they're going to try and jump that far this fast.
So these people, I love these questions because they anticipate my question. Some have suggested, if you read the news and if you read the briefs, I think Professor Morrison said, you know, that this is an issue better left for Congress, perhaps because of the unintended consequences, perhaps for other reasons. Mm-hmm. Somebody asked about, you know, the legislation currently in Congress. I mean, what do you think of that suggestion? I'll just leave it open-ended for you.
Yeah. So we're talking about legislation that largely constrains or bars universal injunctions. If it were legislation that actually said, we think these are great, go forward, I'd have an issue with that because, again, we'd see a constitutional inconsistency there. But as for the existing legislation, look, we would always prefer to see things happen through Congress. I think it just creates more credibility for and sort of political buy-in. You know, we've written briefs on why it's great for Congress to be involved. So that would be wonderful. But I also think there is just the political world that in which we live, where Congress is sort of struggling to engage with even some of its most basic functions, like passing a budget. So I'm not high on the prospects of that legislation succeeding. We would do everything we could to support it, I expect. But I just don't know that we're going to get there anytime soon. I know that I saw some legislation sort of more recently introduced on this issue, and I honestly don't remember who introduced it or where, but I also remember some coverage basically announcing it as dead on arrival upon introduction. So I guess I'm not the only one who's sort of pessimistic about the prospects there.
Okay. So one other question before we maybe wrap and see if other folks have questions online, but just as a more general matter, I mean, you mentioned the shadow docket or the emergency docket. I think what one calls it perhaps depends on who's in power at the time.
Hey, Professor, are you out there? Who knows?
Yeah. who's a law school classmate of mine. But anyway, the court seems to be setting cases, emergency application cases for argument more often. I mean, maybe more often is just greater than zero.
Right.
Writing more, even when they don't set it for argument. I know recently they did issue sort of an old fashioned, like one paragraph. We can't remember which one it was, but what do you make of that trend? Is this the court responding to criticism or what?
I don't know that it's as straightforward as just like they're responding to the criticism, but I think maybe there has been some thoughtful deliberation within the court, and they are recognizing that the best decisions don't always come out of these one paragraph orders. I find it an encouraging step. I think it's a very good thing that we, as led by Ohio, we as a state coalition got kind of one of these unusual emergency application full arguments and orders of our own. And I found that process to just be better for everybody. We got a fuller opinion. We got some real insights on what the court was thinking about that particular rule in that case. And so I'm encouraged to see that. I also wonder a little bit, I've noticed there have been a couple separate opinions from some of the justices really taking lower courts to task for issuing one line unexplained orders, particularly against states and enjoining their own legislation. So I wonder if, you know, you mentioned Goose and Gander earlier, I wonder if they're kind of, as they're getting a little more irritated with those sorts of tactics in lower courts, they're like, well, then who are we to criticize unless we're kind of doing the work we're asking of them? That's my own speculation. I don't know. It felt like those two things were happening at the same time, where they were more focused on their own docket and giving fuller opinions, while at the same time we saw a couple of those, you know, really ripping, not ripping, but chastising, I guess, lower courts for not writing a little bit more themselves.
So there's a question here that is actually, once again, people reading my mind, similar to a question that I was going to ask you too. The question is, do you think the court will want to treat preliminary injunctions any different from permanent injunctions? I had a related question about the spate of TROs and whether you thought that they would have anything to say about that. But you know, to take that in whatever order you'd like.
Yeah, so I think some of the practical considerations that I flagged earlier about underdeveloped record and lack of briefing and the sort of rushed nature of things are only heightened when it comes to the preliminary injunction context and the TRO context, especially. So I think the need to act might seem most pronounced in that context, but I'm not sure that really the legal tests necessarily change. I think that the ultimate question of what they can and can't do really doesn't vary when between preliminary and final. I guess just for the sake of completeness, I guess I'll say, you know, earlier when we were talking about the APA, I said that there could be a preliminary injunction that really is in service of the ultimate vacatur, which is not injunctive relief. So maybe that's one context in which you do have to pay attention to posture. But in a case like this one, I'm not sure it's necessarily going to make a difference. But honestly, Albert, this is where I want to cheat a little bit. I mean, you know these issues well. I mean, do you have this is one that people aren't talking about. And so I'd be curious to know if you've thought about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think my thought on it is similar to yours, which is I think in the APA context, it does get potentially messier. Right, because the final relief is vacatur, and so in the permanent injunction context, if you're willing to grant vacatur to one person, you can certainly grant vacatur. It applies to everybody because it's gone.
Right.
You know, very different from what is it? Jonathan Mitchell has the root of erasure fallacy, right? Like the statutes aren't erased, but the regulation is erased. I mean, that's the whole point of the set aside, although I guess there's some dispute over what that means. But and in the preliminary, maybe in the preliminary injunction context, it's a little, you know, there's some complication in the APA context because you're not actually setting it aside. Mm-hmm. So perhaps you could only enjoin it as to the parties before the court, again, tabling the associational question. So I don't know. It's a good question, but I tend to agree with you in the universal injunction context. Outside of the APA, it's hard to see a difference.
Right. Yeah, to the extent that these are constitutional jurisdictional issues, they're one of the same for both.
All right, well, that covers everything I had. I mean, is there anything else I've forgotten that you want to mention? Any other thoughts you have?
Not really. I guess I would say I'm excited to see the court taking a remedies case. You don't see a lot of these. And I always liked remedies in law school, maybe because I had a really good professor. But a lot of times these big issues ultimately turn on remedies. And especially, you know, as a state lawyer, that's really where rubber meets the road for us. And so it's nice that we're theoretically going to get guidance of some kind, one way or the other, on an issue that it's kind of been left by the wayside for too long. So I'm excited.
Right. We will give people like another minute if there are other questions. I mean, and Edie might be covering this, but if you enjoyed this conversation, join us again on Friday. We'll run it back again. Michael will join me to do a courthouse steps and reflect on what we hear or had heard at that point in the argument tomorrow. It looks like we may have one more question. Will the court take up birthright separately?
Oh, yeah, maybe. honestly, I would actually say probably, but that's always a tough guess. So, but as I said earlier, not in this case, just somewhere down the road.
Sometime down the road, assume that there's a permanent grant of relief here or something.
Right.
And the government takes it up.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, Edie, shall we call it?
Great. Yeah. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I just want to thank you guys very much for being here, Michael and Albert. And we're super grateful for your time and expertise. And as Albert mentioned, you can tune in again this Friday for a Courthouse Steps oral argument where we'll be discussing the actual argument in the Supreme Court. And you can stay up to date with other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you to our audience for joining and participating, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.